The theater. The theater.
Bring out Louise.
Theater. Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater. Theater.
Friends, how you doing?
Hi.
How y'all fringing?
Ooh. It's great. I'm having a great time. I'm already very tired because I think I'm just out of shape from keeping the schedule.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
And but I'm having a great time, so it's a good
time. Well, plus you're doing shows, and you did you had a whole other show outside of it last week, so it's all that. Like, I got to catch my breath a little yesterday, and then we have the party tomorrow, and then all of it.
On a Wednesday.
Yeah. I've seen some great stuff. I've seen some clunkers, and I've seen some stuff that I'm not even going to talk about.
Right?
Same. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, but it's Fringe, and that's what we love about Fringe. Mm-hmm. But I've been listening back to our old back catalog. I've been listening to some early episodes. I ran into friend of the pod, Sam Barrios, the other night. And she was like, I was listening to your old episode where you guys covered movie musicals, specifically the Rocky Horror Picture Show Les Mis episode.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, yeah, that was fun. And she was like, I kind of agreed with your side, Bailey. And I was like, oh, good, I love that. So I went back to listen to it because I was like, I don't remember what was said on that. And it reminded me of how I feel about the movie Les Mis. And I came up with something that relates to another episode that we've done, which is Showgirls. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why I, Bailey, love the movie Les Mis and I love the movie Showgirls are kind of for the same reason. And here's my reasoning. And I think this, and I think y'all know this about me in general with like the things that I like, but I think I love Les Mis for the same reasons I love Showgirls, because they're curio pieces. And they're like these things that shouldn't be the way they are, and yet they are. And I have like a guilty pleasure for those things. Like Showgirls is Paul Verhoeven trying to make like this like dark satire of the entertainment industry. But it's viewed in like a billion other ways than that. Mm-hmm. And rarely as that. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
Tom Hooper is trying to make Les Mis into a dark, gritty, messed up, like raw version of this really pristine thing that we always see on stage.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And he like fails so miserably and casts people who make no sense. And but when I'm watching that, I can't help as an artist be like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
This exists.
Yeah.
And I like the gross, gritty rawness of that movie juxtaposed against like hiring Hugh fucking Jackman. You know, like
Right.
I don't know what it is, but I think it's interesting. And I think it's maybe why I like the movie Cats.
I love a good glorious failure.
Yeah.
I love something that like just like swings for the fucking moon and misses, but there's still moments of just like wow, you know.
Now here's something like, that doesn't
all
fit
fell
in that
flat
category
for me, but you
sure,
know.
Sure. Now here's something that falls flat for me that I think most people would try to put in this category: Greatest Showman.
Ugh.
Greatest Showman is not in this category.
No.
It's way too earnest. And trying to do something that's already been done 100 times. It's not like a huge swing. It's like a
It's also just way
cartoon.
Too wrong.
Yeah, it's
like
it's,
well,
it's way too nice. And, you know, if it would have gone and really showed all sides of that dude.
Yeah.
Like really showed the dirt under his fingernails and then wrote songs accordingly.
Yeah.
Then that would be one thing, but
just make it about a showman who is not P.T. Barnum.
Right.
If you want the Disneyfied storytelling, then like do that. Don't
make up a character.
Yeah. Don't use a problematic figure of history.
Yes.
Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, Hamilton. Awesome. We're throwing out some. We shit talk a lot on this podcast. We do.
Well, that's part of the gig, right?
Yeah. You know who called me out on it the other day was Casper. friend and past and future guest of the pod, Casper, is in Transparent the Musical currently. Mm-hmm. And I went and saw it. And then afterwards, we got to talking and they were like, I love your podcast because you guys shit talk so much. I think we're just opinionated and they very direct.
That was the concept of the show.
Sure.
Was us getting the three of us getting drunk after seeing a show and shit talking it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then I think it was like a week later we saw something else that we loved and
shit talked that was, too.
Yeah, and then was like let's do it. Like let's talk about it because when something hits, I think it's fair to say, like, we're all pretty responsive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Dig it. Yeah.
So. No, that's true. There's a few Fringe shows I'm really excited for y'all to see, because I saw them alone, and now I'm like, okay, y'all need to see them so we can talk. But we'll talk about those on our Fringe Blast. Today is a special thing, so I'm going to go ahead and introduce the episode.
Please.
Welcome all to Theater Theater. The theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the L.A. theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Burcham.
I'm C.J. Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
This is correct. And each week, we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. And this week is a C.J.'s pick. What'd you pick, C.J.?
I picked Dionysus in 69. It was a production. They played 68 through 70, and then they finally filmed it towards the end of its run.
Yes.
In two different shows.
The
so
final
you're seeing
two
different shows side to side the entire time.
Correct.
Which I have a clever snotty
both
thing
hard
to
watch
say.
And interesting. What, Scott?
Well, we watched these through various lenses, and this one was specifically 16 millimeter.
That's true.
It was 16 millimeter.
Two different 16 millimeter cameras. Yeah, various lenses.
And it was Brian De Palma, an early Brian
De Palma.
So we'll talk about that.
Performance director was Richard Schechner, which is somebody that I probably pretended to be a huge fan of in college and afterwards, but I actually don't know anything about him. Sure. I pulled off environmental theater off of my bookshelf, and I am now going to read it.
It's we'll talk about some of it because he also starts to, and he talks about this, and it's on Wikipedia and stuff, where they were using like some attack therapy tactics, which was a therapeutical sort of rage scream kind of therapy that were being used with drug addicts that I don't know if it's necessarily a healthy thing. And we'll talk about it more as we go. Like there's a lot in here that, as an artist and as a performer and as a producer, I'm like, no, you couldn't do that today.
Yes.
No way in hell could you do that today.
Agreed.
Nor should you. But at the same time, there's a reaction. It's a visceral experience to watch and to watch unfold. I'm sorry, I interrupted you, Bailey. I'm a little scattered and I don't know what's happening.
I don't think you did. I don't think I was interrupted. I don't know what I would have been saying. I'm excited to talk about it. I watched it for the first time today. I hope you don't have a Scottopedia because I feel like we kind of just did it.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
No.
There's not really much else to tell. That's kind of the gig, but I want to hear why you chose it. See, like, what's your relationship with it? And then what is yours, Scott? Because I had never seen this. I literally maybe had heard it spoken about, but I knew nothing going in. I put it on and went, oh, it's De Palma. Cool. Interesting. And that, you know, that's how it started.
Hmm. Well, I, halfway through school decided to get a degree in religious studies and started, the connection that I was starting to do was like ancient and neo-paganism in relation to theater. So like the ancient Greeks and shamanism and all that stuff. So my school offered a lot of really cool classes that kind of cross between theater and religion. And one of my favorite ones was called Ritual to Performance. And we watched this towards the end of the semester. And it just really stuck with me. I loved this type of stuff in college. In fact, my final project for my religion degree, I worked with a directing major and we did a production in the school quad of Jean-Claude Van Italy's The Serpent, which is kind of in this vein to political theater, lots of moaning and groaning and yelling on stage, sacred space type of shit. We had a funeral march at the beginning. Like we started in a different part of the campus and we had a funeral march to the actual performance space. So like I don't even know if it worked back then, but I was 21 and really excited about theater from the 60s.
Yeah.
So this is something that's always, and rewatching it today, I was kind of worried I was going to hate it. And actually it got me excited all over again watching it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I had seen it and had forgotten about it. I remember somebody shortly after college had a VHS copy. He was like, "Oh, we should watch this," and I did. You know, I remember, you know, the story and you know, when I did my Greek mythology class and Dionysus and all that stuff. But I wasn't super into it. I'm not a big Greek fan. And so when it's done well or done in an interesting way or a compelling way, I'm kind of sucked in. And then I remember that there's always been a huge debate about the play, the Bacchae.
I think they called it the Bacchae.
Because we're not quite sure what the intent is. Like, you can do a lot of analysis. You can even get the original. They have some of this original text from 405 BC that still exists. We're not quite sure what Euripides was talking about. It was most of his life and most of his writings were anti-gods. He was being critical of people for worshiping the gods. This one is a very distinct departure, and people were like, "Oh, is he saying no? You should, because you don't want that wrath and you don't want that anger coming at you." But I've always kind of taken it as, "No, fuck you and fuck this dude, like fuck this whole thing." So that's another interesting thing, is like you can just talk about the play and the idea for days and days. The story is relatively straightforward and simple, but the execution, and in this particular case, oof, that execution is insane.
We read the Bacchae in my humanities class, my senior year of high school. And I remember, because it was a play, like clipping through it really quickly.
It's a short play.
Yeah, it's real short and easy to consume, but I also remember writing a paper on it and not knowing what the fuck I was talking about.
I
was just thinking, like, senior in high school, they had you reading this? That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, we also read Waiting for Godot that year, the same in the same class. It was a very interesting class, you know, and at the end of the semester, or at the end of the year, every single person, my brothers who are a decade older than me, had to do it, the same teacher. It's called the Good Life paper. Every single person that graduates from my high school has to write one, and it's a 20-page minimum paper on what you believe is the meaning of the good life. But you have to reference everything you read that year in humanities. So you have to reference Godot, you have to reference the Bacchae, you have to reference even smaller things that we covered, like Gift of the Magi, and what are some bigger things? Or even like real small shit. Like you had to I made like this huge long section just referencing the John Donne poem Maru. Where we were. Like it was cool class. It was really cool. His name was Mr. Michael. He's still teaching that class, I'm pretty sure, and has been for 40 years or some shit. I still have my my Good Life paper. Mine's 40 pages, and 20 of the pages are the paper, and 20 of the pages are a children's book that is thematically connected to what I'm writing in the paper.
Nice.
Wow.
Cool.
And I because I was a weird fucking high schooler who just did random shit like that. And I got a C on it, because I didn't reference enough of the stuff from the semester.
Uh-huh.
But then you have to go in front of a adjudication board of teachers and like present your case about your good life. And they all liked it so much that they fought against it. And I ended up getting a high B. Very proud of that.
Yes.
Hard to get.
Yeah.
When I was 18 years old.
Yeah.
We
should stay on this topic for a little bit. I have a lot of things to work out from that time. It was, you know, but then I went to theater school and got into some of this kind of shit that we're talking about today. So let's start from
I got the breakdown. If anyone wants a breakdown.
We always want the breakdown.
Yes.
CJ's Breakdown.
A modern retelling of Euripides' The Bacchae, performed by the Performance Group and directed by Richard Schechner, in a converted garage, complete with birthing ceremony, ecstatic ritual, a bloody death, jock straps, and titties.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. A lot of butt, a lot of titties. That's okay. That's all right. That was all right.
A lot of butt, a lot of mouth.
Yes.
Right. Yes. A lot of mouth. Very specifically mouth. Yeah.
Which are the same thing. So that
they are the same things. Yes. We've gotten away from that this season, but mouths and butts.
We've gotten away from it for a while, but I want everyone to know, since the beginning of this podcast, it has been known, it has been foretold that it is written.
It is writ
that mouths and butts are the same. They're the same thing.
Yeah. So
if you're not aware, look it up.
Look it up.
Dionysus would agree.
But this was full of that. Yeah, this was full of spit and shit, and I love it.
Yeah.
This was... Can I... Okay, I'm going to start. I've been holding back a little bit.
Yeah.
I think this is mildly my Jodorowsky. And what I mean by that to you, CJ, like I'm CJ and this is my Jodorowsky.
Uh-huh.
I was watching this the whole time, just not into it. Like from moment one. Like, so the first thing that happens is we see the X rating and I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
I'm like, here we go. Okay.
Pretty rated uptight X. America. Because like they were more covered for this than they were for most of the production.
Well, so right. Yeah. So they covered themselves up during central scenes and whatever so that they could film it and get away with it and get it shown places.
Because
so it wouldn't just be seen as porn. But it's not porn. That's the other thing is that there's... It's
not sexy,
almost asexual.
Really. Yeah.
It's like Showgirls. It's mildly asexual for how sexual it is. But my point in this is not that I like disliked it. Like, I get it. But I mostly was in a state of cringe. And I think it's partly that I don't love this side of theater. I have seen a lot of shows like this. And maybe it's the aspect of the audience being involved. Maybe it's whatever. Where I saw a Red Cat show years ago. That it's an experimental theater. And so I knew what I was walking into. But it was this CalArts group that had brought in this piece that was set to this really dark, old Thelonious Monk song that was kind of racially charged or whatever. Mm-hmm. And a lot of nudity and a lot of, like, people jumping rope with their balls flapping. And, like, a lot of this that were... And, like, they all had iPod headphones in and shit. And then it was over, and I was like, I got nothing. I got nothing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what this is about. I don't know why I watched that. I didn't. And theater of discomfort is interesting. Theater of cruelty is interesting. But mostly, I'm sitting there as a theater maker going, this feels like masturbation rather than actual, like, affecting theater. And while watching this, I got a lot of that. I got a lot of me being like, okay, they're doing this orgy dance thing at the beginning, right? This is one of the first things that... Well, the first thing that happens in the film is the theater exercise sort of grunting all together.
The warm-up.
It was like I was walking into a voice and speech or movement class.
Yeah.
In college.
And so right away, I'm in college. I'm in a college theater community all of a sudden, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, we're in early experimental educational theater, which... you know, in 68, was new and was really profound and really crazy. Now, it does feel a bit like 20-year-olds being like, look how perverse. I'm like, yeah. Now, there were things that did affect me. I thought the birthing ceremony was cool as fuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, if I was witnessing that, I think I would have been really into that. And then the pieces that do get into more movement-based... kind of I was really in for it. And obviously everybody's really committed. But once we get to that 5-minute orgy dance that is supposed to sort of bring in the audience with them, I, as a theater goer, most likely would have been pretty turned off by that. And not because of the boobs, not because of the dicks, not because, but just purely just like, ah, I'm not, I Bailey don't love being a part of the show. I don't, I think immersive theater is interesting, but I don't like Head Over Heels was hard for me at the Playhouse, you know, where we did it sort of immersively, where it was like, you're in the show with them. That was tough for me. I was like, this isn't fun for me. Like they're all really great, but I'm not into it. And so I was feeling a lot of that. And then Scott, you brought up the attack therapy and you can feel when I read that they worked on this for months and months and months,
like six days a week, 6 hours a day for months on end. Yeah. My producer brain was like, I assume these folks aren't
that late 60s. I mean, shit was just fucking different.
I get it. And I think if I put myself in that time, I'm like, I probably would have been with them.
You would have been in that group,
you know, but now watching it, I could not help but think the whole time. Now, I'm excited to discuss the merit, but I just wanted to say this piece of this puzzle for me. I felt the entire thing was for the performers and not really for anyone else. And I think that's my biggest problem with a lot of theater these days.
Sure.
And at the time, I think it was probably very interesting. And in educational theater, I think it's really great for us to get to do these kind of things. But as a piece of theater, and especially as a piece of film, it was so hard to watch. Not just because it was on YouTube, but the two screens and the fact that it's two different performances, that was hard for me. But that's a De Palma thing, and we can talk about all that kind of stuff. But I just had to get that out. I just wanted that string out of there. Because I also see the merit, and I see all the great things, and I want to talk about those things. But there is that underlying...
Well, to piggyback off of what you said, there was a part of me that was aware that when I finished doing The Serpent at school, and we only had one performance of it, and we just had weird shit on stage. We didn't have a bunch of stuff where like the audience was being drawn in. They were just supposed to be a part of it and around the sacred space that was our stage.
Sure.
There was a part of me that was incredibly aware that I thought, I'm really glad I got to do this because I am not going to be able to go out and work in a theater and do this anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing maybe that I got out of it watching it again with the audience participation, and I get the whole thing about it being masturbatory, but to me it was almost a demonstration of mob mentality.
Sure.
And ecstasy and people getting fucking wrapped up into shit. Because I imagine there were audience members that would leave and be like, I can't believe I just fucking did that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because some people were taking off their clothes and they're like really getting into it.
Mm-hmm. Almost too much. And this goes back to what you were saying, Scott. Like, you could never do this today. There were people, if you start watching the background, I put it up on my phone because I couldn't see it well on my bigger screen because it's a YouTube transfer and it's not great. So, but if you watch it on a small screen, you can kind of see a little better. So I was watching it on my phone. If you watch in the background in some of those shots, there are just audience members that will like stand up and be like, okay. And they just start stripping off and you're like, wait, what's going on? But then they all start like, it gets a little bit like perverted voyeur, like where people start walking up and like touching the actors and stuff.
Yes.
And I was like, whoa.
Which ended up being an issue with the production.
Yeah. We had talked about this off mic, CJ, because we know somebody who was there. Who got to see this?
Really?
Yes.
Can we say who?
Let's not. because they got involved with it, and they kind of talked about how they jumped in, and they started grabbing women and stuff like that. Like, and that was where it kind of shut down. It was that some of the women were really getting molested and touched and
then hearing that story from that person, I was like, we literally talked about you in my class in college because they brought this up in my at school about how like they had to ultimately shut down the performances, but also they had to change things as they went along because mainly the women were coming forward and saying like, this is no good for me.
I mean, it's a shame. It's a shame that people weren't getting the experience or were going too far with it. There's an element of, this is a slight digression, I suppose, but of cultishness to it.
Sure. That, mom mentality is a good way to put it, though.
Yeah.
Because it's an experiment of, it's sort of like that woman who, there was this woman, and I want to say France, I'm probably wrong, maybe Belgium, but she was this woman who would stand outside naked, but with a box around her lower half, and it had like a sign that would say, "You can do anything to me. You're allowed to do absolutely anything to me." And there was like a table in front of her that had like feathers and like a dildo, but it also had like a knife.
Jay and Natalie were telling me about, it was an art installation.
It was an art installation, right.
Yeah.
And so that's what I mean, is like it this sort of feels in the same vein, except not on purpose maybe, but I mean, it's kind of trying to do the same thing. But her whole thing was like, how far will people go if they have the consent to do anything? And she like got held up. Someone ended up putting a razor blade to her neck at one point, and like people had to stop him. And people were like touching her in all the awful ways, putting things inside of her, doing all this awful shit. And she ended up not being okay sort of afterwards, but also was really like, no, I wanted to do this to show how humans interact with this kind of...
Well, and Jay and Natalie told me about this. The best part of that whole thing was at the end, because there was like an amount of hours that people could do it. And at the end of the installation, she looked at because the room was crowded. She looked at the entire room and then started walking towards them like accusingly, and the room cleared out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I got chills.
Yeah. No, I imagine that being in that room was extraordinary. Watching it from a distance probably wasn't as much. Like that was the thing about this Dionysus 69, was that it was visceral. I think I'm right in between both of you in my views on it. I was into it. I was fascinated by the intensity of it, by the commitment of everybody.
Yeah.
But I was kind of... had a filter on going, I've seen this before. I'm questioning this as a theater artist these days, as a director these days, as a producer and an actor, about how to interact with actors and performers and how you bring that all together. And obviously in this day and age, we're far more considerate, far more delicate about how we do that. So I would love to go and interview some of these actors.
Sure.
To talk about their experience being there, being in the moment, being committed to it. How many people, like, how much bullying was done?
Mm.
Yeah.
Whether it was subtle or overt. Like, oh, you're not willing to take off pants, bro?
Yeah.
It's part of the process that got them after months of rehearsal and hours a day. Like, oof.
Well, and you say that whole thing about how they rehearse six hours a day, 6 days a week. That, in turn, makes me think of Jodorowsky, because didn't he make all of his creative team, like, live together and do drugs together and all shit? Because I'm sure this group was doing the same stuff. To be honest, it made me think of the Manson murders a lot.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. That's what I'm... Yeah. I mean, and I wonder... Well, it was... That would have gone on while this was in production from 68 to 69.
It was August of 69 that all that went down.
You know, which brings me back to this whole idea. What is Euripides talking about here? Is worship a good thing or a bad thing? And I think ultimately maybe I'm imposing, but that it is a bad thing. You know, that's why Semele, his Dionysus' mom's murdered. You know, is because they question the truth there. Or it was her sisters that did it, right? It was her sisters that had her killed?
Because no, Hera disguised herself as an old crone because she was jealous that Zeus had a thing for her, showed up at her door, made friends with her, and then Hera was the one that convinced her that she wasn't actually in love with a god. Semele demanded that Zeus show his true form to her, and when he did, it basically lightning bolted her to death, because you can't view a god in its true form.
Right.
I actually have a quote by Schechner on what you were just talking about, Scott, about the idea of what the show is about. Tragedy, from Schechner's point of view, is a problem that will not be solved because the problem is existence.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that as a philosophical discussion, putting it through the filter of, you know, of a theater piece, a performance piece. I'm wondering what audiences gleaned. I wonder if there were audience members who were like, I'm not quite sure what this is all about. And then Bebop walked in. It's like, where's my theme?
I love Euripides.
First of all, like, don't do a theater piece if you ain't got a chair for me. I'm out. That ain't sitting on the ground. I'm not sitting up in a piece on a bench.
Yeah.
No, I'm just
on a scaffolding that they clearly built in the garage. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the fun. That's the kind of interesting thing. This was a very small metal stamping factory.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Where they're performing this. And he called it the performing garage because he said it sounded cooler. It was a jazzier title.
He said it was a jazzier title. It's a garage.
It does say,
man,
here they rehearsed 5 months, at least 6 days a week, on average 6 hours a day, including vocal training, psychophysical interactions, attack therapy. Let's talk about that a little bit before we get into environmental versus immersive versus site-specific.
Site-specific, yes.
Because I think that's a debate we've had here, but I want to do it again.
Yeah.
Attack therapy. It's a controversial method at the time and now. I don't think anybody still uses it. I mean, maybe
people use offshoots of it.
Something like that in conservatory a little bit, actually.
Yeah,
like in theater. But I mean, it's actually meant to be more of a for addiction.
It's for trauma. A psychological thing. Yeah. There are some places that use a derivative kind of elements of
right.
it. I know that scream therapy is still used a lot with kids and young people,
which is great. I mean,
you know, if it's effective,
even attack therapy has its merits. There's been a lot of studies on it. The problem is it's not right for everyone, and it has been sort of enforced on a lot of people who it shouldn't have been enforced on. And that, I mean, and that's the issue with everything. It's the issue with every single thing is that that's why there's spectrums of all things, because everyone is on a different part of the spectrum than everybody else. And so when we're talking about therapy, I could see somebody really taking attack therapy well, but I could see somebody with like legitimate traumas not taking that well, right?
What is attack therapy exactly?
So I'll tell you, but it's really just
I know
a
what
matter
scream
of,
therapy is.
It's similar, but it is a little bit more demeaning. It's more like let me read you this, but it's really a matter of like ripping that person down, like bringing them down.
Very culty then. I've been to cults that do that.
Yeah. I mean, but I know there's acting schools that do that.
Yeah.
There are acting schools that where the principle is to break you down and rebuild you. I think that they're going by the wayside now. But like,
it's verbal abuse, it's denouncement, it's humiliation, and it's always in a group. You're always amongst other people who are going to have it done to them as well.
Oh, yeah. I went to a cult for a couple months that did this.
Probably. Yeah. It's so...
It was called Royal Way. Don't go, anybody.
According to the interwebs, it's one of several pseudo-therapeutic methods described in the book Crazy Therapies.
Hmm.
It involves highly confrontational interaction between the patient and a therapist, or between the patient and fellow patients, during group therapy, in which the patient may be verbally abused, denounced, or humiliated by the therapist or other members of the group. A 1990 report by the Institute of Medicine on methods for treating alcohol problems suggested that the self-image of individuals should be assessed before they were assigned to undergo attack therapy. Because there was evidence that persons with a positive self-image may profit from the therapy, while people with a negative self-image would not profit or might indeed be harmed by the therapy.
Attack therapy, a.k.a. BDSM.
Well, I mean...
Apparently, it's used a lot in captive situations as well, and that's where the methodology began.
Oh,
more
okay,
that sort of thing, and then it became more of like, well, this worked for this one person who was captive. What if we? And then,
you know, Steve's doing real good these days. He's got a got a spring in his step. We
after
just,
that,
I didn't
2 years
coming.
In North Korea, he's doing great.
Oh, like, yikes.
Yeah, I'm great. You know, that's the thing. So, you know, when you start, and I had a similar experience. I had an acting teacher who was a Meisner devotee and then had gone and studied and gotten certified at the Jungian Institute. And so he was bringing in psychotherapeutic elements into acting class, which, you know, and I at the time responded okay. Like, I was like, all right, like, I'm listening. Yeah, I'll admit my shit. But there were people that weren't ready for that. Certainly not 20-year-olds that were ready for that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and so
that's tough.
And it leads also into the whole discussion we've had, too, about guruism in theater in acting schools. And I wonder how much Schechner got off on that part of it.
Could be.
You know.
I mean, he definitely did. He wrote a whole book. I mean, I don't know Schechner. I don't know his work. I don't own that book. I've never read that book. But it does, you know, it does feel like somebody being like, I'm going to break the mold open, just like Brecht did, just like whoever else, right? Like, we've talked about these amazing people who have been able to do that successfully. I think he does do it successfully here. I think he opens the door for a lot of very interesting new forms of theater. I think he's also creating a community in that room, whether it's good or bad. I think there's a community there. But when it comes to attack therapy, I think it was an interesting experiment. I personally don't see the merit moving forward in acting classes and things like actually using it. Mm-hmm. And the Meisner thing is interesting, Scott, because there is some of that too, Meisner.
Very much so.
There is some of that, like, let's break you down.
I was only familiar with Robotic Repeat with Meisner.
Well, that's the first four chapters, right? Is, you know, roboticism and not letting anything through. But then you get to a point where it goes a step further and you start dissecting the other person's self and your own self and...
Understanding. You're right. And coming to an understanding of what those things work. What are those subconscious motivational, psychological motivations for things?
Right.
You know, and that was one of the biggest things that I took away was the defining of what I want or my character wants in that moment.
I took a lot from it just in terms of knowing myself better in terms of how I react to things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I react poorly when somebody points out my weight or my what, you know, like, I know what that feels like now. I can recall that. But then you start stepping into this other method that a lot of people, like, in the recall or whatever you want to call it, but Chubbuck is a big proponent of this, and
Strasberg,
and like anything where it's like, use what you have, use your trauma, which I think can be good for some people too. But
to
again,
me, that's method acting.
Mildly method. I mean, it's the Chubbuck theory. It's the idea that, like, if you've been if you've lost someone, then you should pull up that memory in the moment to feel it. And I it doesn't work for me.
We call that wound picking in acting school.
It's wound picking. Yeah,
it really
I think
is.
For some people it does work, though. I think for some people that's the only way they can get to that place. And that's their method. And I'm like, great. I can't do it. Don't really want to do it.
Right.
I say you should probably just try acting first.
Sure. my acting teacher's theory on that too was the problem with wound picking is that if it does work for you, one of these days that source will dry up.
Oh, that too.
Yeah.
Or it'll go wrong. Or it'll you.
Sure.
Or you'll
sure.
go down some path you didn't mean to go down.
It's just not something you can trust.
Or you'll reopen the wound and more pus and blood will come out.
Gross. Yeah.
Thank you.
And butts.
Real quick, I was just going to talk a little bit. This is pure from Wikipedia, but it's interesting in terms of Schechner, what he learned or what he gleaned as a theater artist in terms of he basically composed three rules regarding the participation, regarding having the audience be a part of this thing.
Right.
Number one, the audience is in a living space and a living situation. Things may happen to and with them as well as in front of them. Number two, when a performer invites participation, he must be prepared to accept and deal with the spectator's reaction. And number three, participation should not be gratuitous.
Mm.
And I'm like, I was like, yeah, but it, you know, it was Chief. Like, it, you know, you can see it. You can see that there's
Blanche.
There was one or two dudes in there that were particularly, you could tell, were either tripping or just stoned.
Yeah.
Fucked up, and they're like taking off my pants, gonna rub it on something. Like, don't care about the play, care about the naked. Where are the titties at? Like, that's the energy you got from some of them. And then there were some, you know, there was a couple of the women, especially later on, when the back knee go crazy, like that are like, oh, okay, like they're kind of like drawn in and in a cool way. So I think that's the trick, isn't it? I mean, the trick of it is that there are some people that are going to be pulled in and want to participate and are excited and energized by it. You can't help but be energized by the energy in the room, the energy and the connection of those performers and the commitment of those performers. Woof, it is electrifying. I can see, you know, and there's moments in the film that capture that really well. But then there's just like... Then there's, you know, there's Bob who I got a flyer. I'm here.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to say my favorite part of the whole performance was when the women turn into beasts and chase him.
Badass.
That was my favorite. I got chills and was really that was my favorite part.
Yeah.
Because it scared me.
Yeah.
That must have been scary to see it in the room.
Right.
It gave me Yellow Jackets vibes. There's, if anyone's watching the show Yellow Jackets on Showtime, it's about a soccer team, all girls soccer team in high school, and they go down in the woods and end up being there for like a couple years. And so it's what did they have to do to survive is sort of the whole mystery of it. But there's an early scene in the first season where they end up all sort of accidentally eating, not sort of, but fully accidentally eating mushrooms. That are
psychedelic,
and they sort of same thing sort of happens where they all sort of transform and end up chasing people through the woods, and it's scary. It's a really intense scene, and I got that vibe from it, and I did like that. I thought that was a solid piece. Like I said at the beginning, the birthing stuff was all really interesting as like a movement piece, and as like, you know, and all the pulsing. And all the meta theatricals and all this. But I want to talk a little bit more about environment and environmental versus, environmental versus immersive versus site-specific. So Schechner is sort of the creator of the idea of quote-unquote environmental theater. And those sort of go by these axioms that he created that sort of relate to what his three rules, Scott, but they're sort of like all space is performance, all space is for audience. The theatrical event can be with space or without space. All production elements speak in their own language. The text need be neither the starting point nor the goal of a production. There may be no text at all, like all this kind of stuff, right? So all things that we still do, all things that, you know, in theater that we still use, and I'm sure were done even before him. He's just sort of focused it into a more definitive, this is environmental theater.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue Head Over Heels at the Pasadena Playhouse was environmental rather than immersive or
site-specific.
Because it was still in a theater, but it was made to feel like a different theater. But the idea was that you were in this place with them. Therefore, you were in the environment with them, but you yourselves were not part of the show, right? Like, they weren't bringing you on stage, having you actually interact things, and they weren't having you... You weren't in some other world. It was still just kind of a stage, right? So I wouldn't call it immersive. But what to you makes something immersive versus environmental?
Site-specific or environmental?
Yeah.
Well, for me, like, this was wasn't quite either. It was an alternative space. It was an environmental space.
It was almost like a happening.
Yeah. But if it was going to be site-specific, I feel like he should have done it in the woods.
Yeah, it's definitely not site-specific.
Out in nature, it needed to be organic.
Yeah.
Now, I think the energy of the group, you know, created a sort of a living organism that you could see. Yeah. But...
And there's an immersion to that.
There's an immersion to that. Yeah.
In the world, sort of, but really... The only immersion is the orgy dance. Right. The sort of like, let's all dance together. That's really the only true immersive piece.
Agreed. It could have been, I guess I would describe it more as participatory than strictly immersive like that. See, you're literally kind of going.
No, they're big questions that I'm trying to think. Like, I mean, I agree with you on the site specific. If it was going to be site specific, then I mean, it's like the amount of times I've heard of people doing site specific Midsummer Night's Dream, where you start outside of the woods and then you're inside of the woods and then you go outside of the woods again by the end of the play.
Yeah.
I agree with you on that. Immersive to me, I've been thinking about that, especially because there's shows we're going to end up seeing that are immersive. I almost feel like you could say that this is immersive when it got to like the participatory part, because then you are brought in as a citizen, as someone that's worshiping with them or whatever.
And they are speaking to you. They are, you know, what's his name? Will Finley at the beginning is like, hello, I'm Will Finley. And I, you know, he brings you in as sort of a character in some way. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you said it all, Scott. It was immersive, site specific, and then what was the third one?
Environmental.
What
in a lot of ways he created the idea of environmental, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Really, he's taking the idea of immersive and making it more about like less. I need to dilute this a little bit, or like, you know, make it a little bit simpler for my brain. But really, to me, environment means I'm in the environment of the show. I'm part of the environment of the show. Immersive means participatory and means like I'm a piece of this story unfolding.
Yes.
If I do something, things could change.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And maybe I'm wrong about that, because I think there are immersive things where I couldn't change anything and it would still feel immersive.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or like maybe I get the idea that I could change things, whether
Two different things. We're talking about spaces, but then we're also talking about the relationship between the audience and the performance, or the performance element is. For example,
site-specific is kind of outside of this conversation, but
I've been to site-specific Midsummer Night's Dreams where I'm still in a chair and I'm watching a performance. I'm in the woods. I'm just not in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little different from immersive. And in this one, he's trying to pull you in.
Yeah.
There's almost an element of, well, certainly temptation, certainly trying to lure somebody in, but, and also, you know, kind of challenging them. Like, it's a little bit of like, hey, you think you're man enough or woman enough to get up here and dance with these people? Like, that's a thing, too.
Well, and I think the thing that ties the bow on it, too, is at the end, I think it's Will Finley turns to everybody in the audience and says, what have you done?
Right, right. Yeah, it's a great moment. Like, there's some beautiful theatrical moments.
Sure.
And, like,
for sure.
There are other elements. Like, I thought that everybody's, like, just vocal prowess, like using their voice in a space to communicate.
I think that was a lot of the rehearsal process.
Yes,
though, was just building that, you know.
Building, absolutely, you know.
And this show was one of my biggest pet peeves, is walking into a rehearsal and they're like, this is a dance rehearsal. And you walk in and the choreographer's like, okay, I'm going to turn on some music and we're going to create together. And I'm like, you didn't write down any dance notes,
organic dancing, come on.
You're making me do it.
Yeah,
exactly.
That, to be honest, even though I kind of geek out over this hippie theater, like, the rehearsal process would have made me want to scream.
Exactly. I actually, maybe that's more what I'm channeling while I'm watching this, that's making me cringe, is me being like, I would never want to do that process.
Yes.
I would never want to do that process. Like, maybe in college I would have been really annoyed.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, no. It sounds like so much like early theater experimental exercises, and like, let's spend
two of our 6-hour days just grunting at each other. Yeah?
Like, okay.
I don't need that.
When I walk into a rehearsal space and the director wants me to do acting games for my freshman year of school, I'm like, no. We are not doing that. Or if somebody wants me to have longer than a 30-minute call before the show, no.
Yeah, right? Like, yeah.
This definitely does break a lot of... You're totally right, because I thought the same thing when I was watching this. Like, there's no fucking way that this could be done now, especially the way that it was done.
At least not out of college, but even in college, when I was in college, which was before you guys were in college... Like, there were still very distinct rules about how much time you were allowed to do, primarily because we often had equity actors, you know, in shows with us. But like, you couldn't have done that. You couldn't have done 5 months of rehearsal, 6 hours a day, mm-mm. 6 days a week, maybe the 6 days a week. But that was kind of Pasadena. When I did Pasadena, we had 6 days a week and, you know, full days, but you were also being compensated fairly well. So,
yes.
It's amazing commitment. As a theater nerd and as an artist nerd, I'm like, good on ya. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would have wanted to ever be in that room. Mm. I don't know if I would have...
If I
was there at the time, I'm sure the energy of it would have made me go see it. But I don't.
It gives way to some interesting things, though, right? Because it opens up theater and theater audiences to the idea of more perverse, provocative, nude. Experimental things. And it sort of leads to things. The first two things that popped into my mind when I finished it were O Calcutta, which is eight people completely nude the whole show doing kind of like sketches and whatever, and which has like a Sam Shepard piece in it and like a Beckett piece in it. And like, it's like this whole thing.
It's a weird thing.
It's really weird. And then have y'all ever heard of Naked Boys Singing?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Musical. I mean, like things like that, like, and not just because of nudity. It's not just that, but there's sort of that, like, American audiences specifically start to sort of open up more to, like, theater is a more liberal art. It's a more open thing. It can be more of that. And it always has been. I mean, vaudeville was all raunch and, you know, and burlesque and all that. I just think this is more of... Not to call it mainstream, because it wasn't mainstream at the time, but Brian De Palma did make a film version of it. So it's mainstream enough that it opened up a lot of doors, I think. And I think that's really interesting. And I love all kinds of theatrical experimentation. And I love theater as ceremony, which is something that CJ, you talk a lot about. And I think this is kind of the epitome of that, right? Without feeling like... an actual cult. It has like that kind of like, oh, we're all here experiencing this really visceral thing together. And there's a ceremony to it figuratively, but there's also a literal ceremony to the whole everything, to the whole piece.
Yeah.
So I get it. I love it for what it is. I also hate it for what it is. So, but it was all super interesting. Can we, for 5 seconds, talk Brian De Palma? Because Scott, you're going to at least have a mild opinion on De Palma. I don't think you and I have ever talked De Palma, which is
it's an odd career. He's one of these dudes that was part of that whole crew.
Was he Dogma? Was he part of the Dogma crew?
No. He was part of that first wave of film school geeks. Your Spielbergs, Lucases, your Francis Ford Coppolas. He was part of that whole thing. And you can see it. It's just his career. Like, he's done some jaw dropping, amazing fucking shit. And he's done some shit where you're like, what are you doing, bro? Like, what's happening?
And just so many movies.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's unreal. You know, I think about Blowout, which I think might be his second best movie.
Oh, wow.
And it is John Travolta, maybe John Travolta's best performance ever. But he plays a sound dude that works for film as a sound guy and records a murder that was done by a politician, and it's a thriller, and it's like really fucking cool. He did Dress to Kill, which is another erotic thriller. Untouchables is probably his masterpiece in terms of.
Yeah, the Untouchables is the one I think most people would say. I really like the direction of Scarface. I think it's a good, Scarface solid directorial film.
Oh, Scarface, yeah, sure,
film.
Absolutely, yeah.
Carlito's Way, like those, kind of in that vein. I'm a Phantom of the Paradise guy.
Yeah, oh, Phantom of the Paradise is so underrated. Yes,
which we
absolutely
brought up on our Phantom of the Opera episode because I was like, let's talk about all the times that there's been like films about or shows about phantoms in a theater. Phantom of the Paradise is great. And then obviously, you know, Mission Impossible. The first Mission Impossible movie is a classic.
Carrie.
A really I've seen solid, that one.
Yeah, a really solid Stephen King adaptation, in my opinion.
Yeah,
like
very much so.
Better than The Shining, that's for fucking sure.
I hate you.
No, I just, the book is scarier, that's all. I've read, I sometimes get a little snotty about the books, and the ending in the book is scary, and the ending of the movie is dumb.
Yeah,
your
argument is heard and understood by many, but really the argument is so much broader than that because, and I'm sorry to do this.
No, do it.
But the problem is that you cannot call The Shining a Stephen King adaptation because it's really not.
It's not.
It's quite different.
It's a Kubrick
movie. It's a Kubrick film. It's the same with 2001: A Space Odyssey. If you read the book, it's just not. It's not the same thing. Clockwork Orange is a totally different ending than the book. The book is a much better ending in Clockwork Orange. But if you watch it as a Kubrick piece and you understand what Kubrick's doing, there's that argument to it. The Shining is a borderline perfect film. Is it scary? Not to me, but it was when I was a child, but not so much. Dr. Sleep, which is the new Mike Flanagan
sequel,
it is both a sequel to the Kubrick Shining and Stephen King's Shining book.
All right.
And I really want to watch it with you, Siege. In fact, I'm going to make us fucking cover it on this podcast because there is a book of it too. There's not a play, but it's okay.
I need to reread The Shining. It's been a while.
But Dr. Sleep fixes everything Kubrick got wrong and gives Stephen King everything he wanted from it. Like and Stephen King has since basically handed over his canon to Mike Flanagan. Like Flanagan is going to be making all the Stephen King movies now.
Which I have special feelings about Stephen King too.
Sure,
anyway,
same.
But we don't need to turn me into a screaming, raging asshole.
Should we talk about It? Should we get into It and the child orgy? Or are we not? We're not into that.
God, it still makes me so fucking mad.
Yeah,
that
I'm
book
not a
scared
King
the
guy.
Shit out of me, and then the last 100 pages ruined it.
Yeah, it sounds bad. I've never read it. But I just wanted to make sure we shouted out the De Palma of it all, because he's shooting it. It's the final two performances, and he's shooting it with two different cameras, and one is a little lighter than the other one, because they raise the lights for one of them. I had so much trouble watching it because of that. It just, for me, maybe it's my ADHD, I don't know, but I was just like going back and forth, kind of comparing
and
contrasting
so much. Really makes you love the Steadicam.
Yeah.
Speaking of The Shining, which was the first movie to use the
Steadicam. Wow, yeah, good point.
Because it's, you're just like...
Rusty trombone.
You know, what?
I don't know, I said pull around and then I don't know.
Rusty.
Reach around, that's what I was going for. Yeah. Okay.
Jesus Christ. Go ahead, Steve.
The one thing that I watched a short interview with Schechner after I finished watching this, because I guess some school in Texas did Dionysus in 69 like 14 years ago or something.
Okay.
College? I don't know. I'd have to look back up the thing. Yeah, I don't think it was like some regional theater that did it.
It was a middle school.
Yeah, exactly. But he said... because I didn't realize it was two different nights until I listened to this interview. And he said, if you notice, but I did notice this towards the end of the film. He said, if you notice on the right side at the end when they're killing the lead character, there's no blood. And he's like, we ran out of blood. We didn't have any blood the last night that we filmed.
That's crazy.
Oh, wow. Crazy.
That moment. Also, I forgot about this. I didn't take a note about this, but that moment was so reminiscent of the ending of the movie Perfume.
Have you ever seen Perfume?
Yeah.
If it's scary, no.
Yeah.
It's not scary. It's called Perfume, The Story of a Murderer. It's a old, it's, the book is by, I can't remember, but I have
the book. You've told me about this before.
Yeah,
though.
I love the book. It's one of my favorite books. It's really weird. And the movie is fantastic. It's Ben Whishaw and Dustin Hoffman and Alan Rickman. And it's about a serial killer who is trying to make the perfect perfume, but he does it out of people's scents. He
That's
kills
right.
them and makes sense out of their essence.
Wow.
And it's incredible and it's really weird. But there's a scene. Oh, I don't want to give it away. Well, there's a scene where that sort of happens, where it's like the mob sort of consumes, like comes over him, and like, and it, I was like, oh, this reminds me of Perfume, and I got excited. No, I want to say I did like this as a piece. I did understand it. I think I understand its merits, especially for the time. I think if I had been there in 69, I probably would have been all about it. But Bailey in 2023,
yeah,
would never.
Yeah.
Period. Would
I don't
never.
Know that any of us would.
Yeah.
I think I might do it with a group of people in a room. I don't think I'd do it in a room with a bunch of spectators and strangers.
You would do it like just for the fun of like doing it with a community of people you trusted and like making it happen.
Hell yeah.
Being
yeah.
naked.
Let's get naked and run around and make
Honestly,
weird noises.
That's kind of weirdly what Full Monty was for me. We were all just
That was
naked
your Dionysus in 69.
Yeah. We were all, but really what I mean is like we all got super comfortable with each other. It was just
sure.
we were always really comfortable. And because early on they were like, all right, take your clothes off. And everyone took their clothes off. And we were like, all right, great. We've seen it. Now move on. And then we did, and we were able to do that. So I think there's merit to things like that. I think there's merit to, as a cast, being as close as possible, being as trusting as possible, being as intimate as possible. And I think we as theater artists can handle that for the most part. We can
sure.
take
I think
that and do it
to.
Respectfully. We just can't always trust our audiences. I
yes,
think
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You just can't trust the rando walking in the fucking room or
yeah.
theatra. I real quick did want to give a shout out. The Bacchae was adapted in 97 at the Complex here in Los Angeles.
Oh, shit.
And got all kinds of awards. They filmed it for the Lincoln Center, and one of the original actors came back and was in it. So,
oh, wow.
I just thought, hold on.
The
actually,
Complex, a.k.a. probably four paint stores and a liquor store soon.
Yeah, well, we'll see. They don't know what's at. I mean, there's all kinds of
Brandon Jacobs Jenkins also did a Bacchae. We talked a little bit
yeah,
about
we did
it
mention
on the
a
episode.
Little bit.
We didn't get to read it. I'd like to
Which
find
one
it
was
it?
It?
It's called The Bacchae.
Oh, it is?
I
okay.
So.
I didn't
yeah.
okay.
Yeah,
that's
it was
cool.
Just his, it was just his sort of adaptation of it. It was supposed to be interesting. We talked about it with Lisa. I can't remember exactly what we said about it. I think she got to see it or something.
Oh, yeah. Maybe you're right.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yes, Will Shepard from the original Pentheus from Dionysus in 69 was Cadmus in the 97 production at the Complex. So,
cool.
Oh, that's
interesting.
Cool.
Small world, you know.
Well, is there anything else we want to say about this? I'm glad we watched it. I'm glad I have
yeah,
this
for
in
sure.
my
I, thank you for
knowledge book
yeah.
now. Yeah,
it was a
thanks
good
for,
Peter Nyer to pick.
Thanks for watching it for me. I mean, it did warm the inner theater hippie cockles of my
sure.
heart for sure.
My cockles were warmed in some parts.
Yes,
to be clear, I just wanted to make sure I stated like my perspective early on.
I'm honored to have perhaps found your Jodorowsky.
I kind of did. This does like something that like gave me the itch that I think Jodorowsky gave you.
Yes.
Like that sort of like, ooh, I feel a little dirty and
yeah.
not in a good way. Yeah.
I feel yucky.
Yeah. but I also like a lot of things that do that to other people. I think Tommy does that to people. I think Jodorowsky
yeah.
does that
Clockwork
to people.
Orange does
Clockwork
that to
Orange
people.
Does that
yeah,
to
yeah,
people.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
okay. Well,
all right.
Should we You know, fucking get out of here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do we do at the end of these things?
Well, we should do an LA spotlight.
Yeah. We don't have to rank anything, right?
No. No.
Okay. Well, let's spotlight some LA theater.
LA Spotlight.
LA Fringe. It's really Fringe. All about Fringe that's right it. Now. That's yeah. That's what's going on. Please visit the Hollywood Fringe website. You can explore it in all kinds of different ways. If you're a theater nerd, you can go down to the Broadwater, which I work at, which is the home of Sacred Fools, which we all have worked at. But I think over a third of Fringe is happening there, and all throughout Hollywood. And like, it's all walkable. There's great drinking happening. But go and see. You can pay $10 and see.
There's great drinking.
Cool, yeah, there's crazy drinking happening.
Yeah.
But you can pay $10 and see amazing shit. And I'll just go ahead and hype our show, or my show, and then I'll have everybody else hype their show. My show is called, well, I'm doing two, but if I'm good, I'm doing it with Nedra Gallegos, who's a wonderful, wonderful actress. CJ came the other night to
preview. Yeah, great opening, I heard.
It was great. It was fucking great. Everyone go see it.
Thank you. And yeah. And it's at the Broadwater Black Box. If I'm good, just search it in the Hollywood Fringe website. And then I'm also doing with CJ,
Raise Your Hand from the Dead, which is also in the Broadwater Black Box. Completely different from If I'm Good. So
the exact
see both of them.
Opposite. But we've gotten some nice buzz for both of them. So.
And one show I just wanted to call out, that another show that I saw that I really, really enjoyed that I called out at the last Fringe one, was Lebanese Debutante was a winner for me.
Like, oh, nice.
It's okay. A one-person show, but she was fucking hilarious and lovely, and the story's interesting. And so, yeah, Lebanese Debutante, y'all. That's at Second Stage, right next door to the Black Box.
And yeah, sorry, I was just going to say, just to give some fair time to other shows, also at the Black Box, or in the Second Stage at the Broadwater, I saw a one-woman show called Jackie, about Jackie Kennedy Onassis, and it was pretty fantastic. It's a little absurdist, it's a little funny, it's not somebody trying to do an impersonation of Jackie O., and the actress was quite wonderful. Go see it, Jackie. It's a one-woman show.
Come see School for Love, the cabaret at Three Clubs. I'll save the rest of my Fringe stuff for our Fringe Blast next week, because I saw some really great stuff and also some not-so-great stuff, which I will also be shouting out. I'll also be talking about. But yeah, I feel like that's it. Come see Hollywood Fringe. It's bumping. Yeah, everyone's
it's going. Great.
I have
it's a great
two shows
time.
Tonight.
I'm going tonight after we're done.
Yeah, I got an 8:00.
I think we're seeing the same one, Paige.
Halfway to Gethsemane?
Yes.
All right.
I just keep thinking of Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah, Gethsemane. Jesus Christ Superstar. We're covering that soon.
Again.
That's not the next one, though. Yeah, okay. Well, we'll see you guys next time. Thank you for joining us for Dionysus in 69, the CJ pick. Next week, we'll have another Fringe Blast coming out for you. And then the week after that is a Scott's pick? Or is it mine? Is it Jesus Christ Superstar?
What? JC Superstar is the week after next. Next week's another Fringe Blast.
Then the next one is Jesus Christ Superstar Live, the NBC Live John Legend starring, Alice Cooper starring.
How dare you?
Jesus Christ Superstar Live, which is one of the better produced ones, because it's less trying to be also musical theater and more just like a arena tour version of it, which is cool. And then after that is other stuff, another Fringe Blast, and then a thing, and then another Fringe Blast, and then Larissa Fast Horse is coming on the podcast.
Yes. It's gonna be awesome,
which is gonna be huge. All right, y'all, that's all I got.
Questions, comments, you can reach out to us via email, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Scott,
thank you so much, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. Our theme song is better than your theme song.
Betch.
And he also writes all of our stingers, and he's cool, and he's a hip dude, and you want to hang out with him and just chat with him. And then finally, to the great award-winning playwright Carol Churchill, who also has a version of the Bucky, who writes every single one of our episodes but doesn't even know it. One day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer.
That's right. Subscribe, rate, review. It really does help. And we love you all. See you later. Spider-Verse the other day. All I'm going to say is it's maybe the best animated film of all time. And that's all I'm going to say. But I was trying to learn a song from Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark for this ending moment. And none of them can stick in your head. It's impossible to learn a song from the music. They
They just, they fly right out of your ear. So, CJ, would you like to sing a song? Let's hear it. What do you got?
I've never heard a song in my entire life.
That's great.
I know sometimes a man is wrong.
Ooh, yeah, here we go.
I know sometimes I do believe. I know sometimes the world is wrong. They'll be wrong until you're next to me.
Great. Now I'm horny. Later, everybody.
Later.
The theater. The theater.
Hang out, Louis!
Theater. Theater.